Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I can only hope that, you know, this child did not die in vain, but that the Syrian government will end the brutality and begin a transition to real democracy.
That was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on Tuesday speaking about Hamza al-Khatib, the 13-year-old boy believed to have been killed and possibly tortured by Syrian security forces, like Neda, who was killed in Iran, or the vegetable seller who self-immolated in Tunisia. The death of this 13-year-old boy has reignited the protests in Syria, where opposition groups are demanding that President Bashar al-Assad step down. Human rights groups put the death toll from the Syrian movement at nearly 1,000, and UNICEF has said there is evidence that other children are being detained and tortured there. This just in from the AP in the last hour. This seems to continue. Activists say Syrian government troops are pounding a central town with artillery and gunfire, killing at least 15 people. The local coordination committees, which help organize and document the country's protests, said the deaths occurred in the town of Rostan today. With the latest deaths, at least 58 people have been killed in that town in the past 3 days. So another place that most of us have never heard of, now becoming a center of protest and government firing in Syria. Human rights groups, as I said, have put the death toll at nearly 1,000 nationally. And yesterday, a conference of over 200 opposition members kicked off at a hotel in neighboring Turkey to discuss goals and how to pressure President Assad out of office. And there is talk of pressure on the United Nations now from Britain and other countries to investigate Syria's nuclear capabilities. Joining me to discuss these developments in the Arab Spring in Syria is Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies and associate professor at the University of Oklahoma. He writes the online newsletter Syria Comment. Professor Landis, welcome back to WNYC.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you.
Tell us more, first of all, and especially for people who may not have heard about him very much yet, about the 13-year-old Hamza al-Khatib, this young boy who was killed, and the circumstances surrounding his death.
Well, this story really symbolizes all of the difficulty we have in understanding what's going on in Syria, and it also demonstrates how both sides are, both sides are putting out completely opposite stories. The story came out through opposition members who said that this young boy, taken by government forces in April, had been terribly tortured and then turned over to his parents. And some people, argued that this is a way that the Syrian government was, intentionally trying to terrify the people by doing this. The government has gone on the airwaves and said this is not true at all. This is opposition spin. The boy was in a demonstration that in Deraa that came up to the housing units of the Republican Guard. People from behind the demonstrators shot at the Republican Guard, killing the commander there. And then fire broke out as the Republican Guard shot at these demonstrators. And the boy was, shot in this crossfire. Nobody knew who he was because he didn't have identity papers. He was kept at the morgue for 5 weeks. And the government said that his body had decomposed. He had no neck, his jaw was falling off, other things like that. By the time they figured out who it was and returned to the parents. So that he was not tortured, they say, but this was the product of natural decomposition. So it's very difficult to tell, which story is true here.
And there are conflicting accounts, but beyond a certain point, it hardly matters which story is true if he becomes a symbol and his death takes on a certain narrative in the public mind.
Because, well, of course,
let me just say,
it is important what's true, but you're right, it is a symbol. And the government has used torture and is brutally cracking down on this protest movement that's hoping to overturn the government that's been in power now for 40 years.
And now posters showing the young boy's picture have been used in protests, and much like Nada in Iran, and the vegetable seller in Tunisia. As I said, the image has become a catalyst for renewed protests. So are we in a situation now because of this, or at least because of this boy as a catalyst, that just when you thought the rulers of Syria had massacred their way out of the Arab Spring, the people seem newly emboldened?
This is a persistent opposition. It's not going away. They've been extremely brave. They've been willing to stand out in the line of fire and keep on coming against this government. As you say, 1,000 have been killed. That could turn into many more before this is through. The government is determined not to be overthrown. The government says, this is going to be like Iraq if we're overthrown. There's going to be a civil war like Lebanon. It went on for 15 years, and we're not going to allow it. Now, this becomes, the Syrians are left with a terrible choice, a Hobbesian choice, between dictatorship, the lack of freedom on the one hand, and what looks like could become a much more difficult civil war on the other hand. And it's hard to see how a middle ground, a constitutional convention, the president resigning and leaving the country, can happen. And we're watching Yemen descend into what looks like civil war.
Yes.
Libya already has. And so the Syrians have a terrible choice on their hands.
When you say civil war, that conjures up a whole other set of images than saying democracy movement or Tahrir Square. So should we make a distinction between the kind of thing that happened in Egypt, where many different groups came together in Tahrir Square, really demanding democracy and due process, no matter what they may want in the long run for their own groups? There was a legitimate democracy movement there for democracy's sake, at least for the moment. Is that different from what's happening in Syria? Is it just more group versus group, or is there something that we would legitimately call a national democracy movement taking place?
Well, you're absolutely right to present it that way, because there are two radically different stories. And the opposition and much of the international media has presented this as lots, Syrian people, Democrats against tyrant. The Syrian government, of course, is presenting it as these are fundamentalists, troublemakers who are trying to destroy our country and are being stimulated by outside powers. And they're trying to ruin Syria and turn it into Iraq. Now, neither of those versions is true. They're partly true. Of course, many of the demonstrators are legitimately asking for an end of tyranny. Many of them are young. 50% of Syrians, 48% are 19 years old or younger. That means they're either freshmen in college or they're high school students. And there is tremendous pressure on Syria to perform in a way that it hasn't. It's failed economically. Syrian government got to 5% growth rate. That's the same as Egypt and Tunisia. But it had failed to get to 8 or 9% growth rates like Turkey, Brazil, China. And that means that this rapid population growth, a giant youth bubble, no employment, no prospects of the future, 40 years of failed policies, 40 years of dictatorship. They want a change. Now, there are plenty of good Democrats. Will it turn into democracy? That's the big question. What is the most likely scenario for the future? Now the government is saying the most likely scenario for the future is Iraq or Lebanon. Look at all neighbors. What kind of track record do you have in a multi-ethnic, multi-confessional society where people don't live easily with each other? This is not Egypt. This is not Tunisia, where everybody's a Sunni Arab, and they all belong to the same group. A few little Christians in Egypt, but they don't have political power. Here in Syria, the Alawites, a Shiite offshoot, are about 12% of the population, 10% Christians, another 5% of smaller minorities, who are clinging together. That's about 25% of the population are supporting this government. It's not true for every Christian or every Alawite or every, but by and large, the minorities are clinging to this government because they see it as secular and it's protecting them. It's privileged them in the past. Mm. They don't want, Sunni fundamentalists that they fear. Now, whether that fear is legitimate, who knows? In Iraq, we were told that there was going to be a secular government where they would have power sharing and get along when America went in there and kicked over Saddam Hussein. What did we get? We got a million dead, or hundreds of thousands. We don't know how many. And you know, and there were plenty of children who were dead in there, too. We don't know what we're going to get. We've had dictatorship for 40 years.
Thank you for explaining that dynamic in such fullness. How does it relate to the news of this morning that I read before in a place, do you say Rostan? Is that how you pronounce the name of that town? Rostan in the province of Homs, the latest flashpoint location. Syrian government troops are pounding that town with artillery and gunfire, according to activists, killing at least 15 people. At least 58 people have been killed there just in the last 3 days as the army has been conducting military operations. Why there? Do you know?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that they're using artillery. I doubt it. You know, in Humps, they said they used tanks, and people from the U.S. Embassy assured me that they hadn't used tanks, but they had used, of course, heavy gunfire, and they were killing people. This is part of a larger, you know, opposition movement around Humps, and Humps is the third largest city in Syria. Alawites and Sunnis live together. A lot of the violence has come in towns like Latakia on the coast, Banias, Jebli, Homs. These are areas where Sunnis and Alawites live together. And there's been a big Alawite influx from the peasantry and the countryside around. Alawites are generally poorer than the Sunnis living in the cities. And they have moved into the city. And, of course, they're the ruling, you know, the Alawites rule. So there's been a lot of friction. And there's been bad government in Homs. There's been a series of governors who are Alawite secret police heads who've been quite corrupt. And there's a lot of bad blood.
Jonathan Landis with us on WNYC. He writes the newsletter Syria Comment. He's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and a Syria expert. So at the same time that all of this is going on in Syria, there is a major Syrian opposition conference taking place in the city of Antalya in southern Turkey today. One of the main goals of the meeting is to set up a 31-person committee to implement decisions made by this coalition and basically have a government in exile or, you know, a leadership of the opposition in a coordinated way in Syria. Who will likely be part of that, given what you just said about the ethnically disparate nature of the groups?
Well, we're waiting to see. They've explicitly said that they're not trying to set up a government in exile because this would cause great criticism at home, because the opposition members leading this protest movement at home would scream bloody murder if the exiles tried to set up a government. This would be redolent of Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress trying to move in and rule Iraq after the government falls. Right. So there's been great sensitivity about the outsiders versus the insiders.
But there's both, right? I understand that people have gone from Syria.
There have been some.
Let me play some clips just to give our listeners a sense, and you'll be interested in this too if you didn't hear today on Morning Edition. NPR's Deborah Amos filed a report from this opposition gathering, and she spoke to two young opposition leaders there. The first is Aziz Ufman, who spoke through an interpreter. He arrived at the meeting limping from a gunshot wound, she reported. The second is Omar Mokdad, a 25-year-old who's been using social network to organize opposition.
He's not in the movies. It's in reality. He's the Mel Gibson of reality.
They came to my house. They broke the doors. They want to kill me there because I'm in the media.
So those are two young guys. Do you know them or of them? Did they come from Syria to this meeting of opposition leaders in exile who were generally older?
Well, one of them I have heard of before who did come from Syria. The other one, I'm not sure if he's from outside or inside. I just don't know. But there have been a number of Kurds came from Syria. Muslim Brotherhood leadership has come from outside the country largely because they're proscribed inside. But then there were a number of activists, and they were the heroes of this. I think everybody focused on them, these young people who've been driving the protest movement on the ground, because there's a natural division between old opposition leaders who are the heads of established parties like the Muslim Brotherhood, the Kurdish parties, leftist parties that are an older generation, and the new leadership, which has popped up with this demonstration, that's been largely faceless up to now, who are these social media people who are in their 20s and early 30s who are driving this movement on the ground and who are so courageous. And there is, you know, down the line, there's going to be a tussle between these different generations and with different mentalities, different outlooks. And they're trying to avoid that tussle. They're trying to come up with some kind of plan where all these different groups will get together. And over something like 60% of the people, of the 200 people there, were from the Kurdish groups, which at first said they were going to boycott the meeting because it was held in Turkey and they don't like the way Turks are treating their Kurds. And they had not been, some of them had not been informed by their Arab peers about what was going on. So they were upset. And at first they said they would boycott, but then they decided to go. They turned up, 65 of them turned up. And then the Muslim Brotherhood turned up in pretty strong numbers. So over half of the participants were from those two groups. And then there were the young, you know, American-based, Western-based activists who've been who we know the best and have been on NPR and other places for quite a long time and have been working closely with American groups here to lead this social media opposition. And then there were these people from inside Syria. And so everybody was focusing on this new generation of leaders that has appeared from inside Syria.
There's another group that I'm interested in. When we had you and New York Times reporter Anthony Shadid on in mid-May, you both noted that economic considerations are important for Assad and for Syria. And now there's word that the usually pro-Assad business community may be backing the opposition in this conference in Turkey. What do you know about that?
Well, Sankar is the man who has been gotten the most attention. He was the head of Mercedes concession in Damascus for decades. His family, his children had taken over after the old man. And then the president's cousin tried to cut him out in 2005 and pulled one up. Now, the Germans didn't go along with this, the Germans who had been dealing with the Sankar family. And this became a typical insider-dealing Syrian corruption story where the president's cousin pushed out this old Demosyne family. They're still licking their wounds, and they're determined to get some revenge and to try to get back to Damascus. They are funding this meeting in part, so that they have got some notoriety. They're the only funding group that's come forward and announced that they're backing this. You know, it's possible that other groups are getting their money from elsewhere, but we don't know about that.
I read a stat that President Assad's cousin, Rami Maklouf, reportedly controls an estimated 60% of the Syrian economy. You think that's true?
No, I don't think it's true, but we don't know. The point is the Syrian economy at the top, the big firms, are, it's not clear how they're owned. There are people like Rami Maklouf who've got interests in many different holding companies and the gas and oil companies. He owns the duty-free shops. It is a big octopus with lots of tentacles. There's no doubt about it. And he is a sort of Mr., you know, 20%. This is the way the government keeps the Sunni business class sweet, is it participates, gives them privileges, lets them have licenses, helps them make lots of money. But they have to, in a sense, become loyal to the government by becoming business partners with the government.
We're almost out of time, but I have to bring up Britain's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency said yesterday that Syria ought to be investigated because, as though, you know, as if the violence and the threat of civil war in the country were not intense enough, Britain is saying here that there's a nuclear threat from the Syrian government against its own people. Is that the charge?
You know, there was in 2007 a plant in the desert that was bombed by the Israelis, and in U.S., this is under the Bush administration, U.S. gave considerable intelligence support and other support to that effort. Now, the UN investigative committee believes that that was a nuclear plant that was not told about, so that they were breaking their participation in this non-proliferation agreement. Now, what's happening right now in the larger context of this is that increasingly Europe and the United States governments are moving to sanction Syria. They've placed the president and the top 10 people under personal sanctions. The EU has cut off all aid to Syria. This is for building electric plants, other things. They've stopped that. So increasing, and there's more and more calls for the U.S. to take action in Syria. Now, one of the ways that they can put pressure on Syria is to try to get it in front of the UN for breaking this treaty, UN treaty. And it would be one of a myriad of different ways to put pressure on the Syrian government. And increasingly, the West is beginning to think of how can we get the Assad regime out. They don't want to send army. The best way to do it then is use international organizations like the UN, sanctions to try to squeeze the Syrians and the Syrian economy till it busts. And then, you know, hope that something else comes out of it besides civil war.
Fascinating. Well, we will see what happens. We'll certainly see what happens at this opposition leaders conference in Turkey over the next couple of days and whether they come out with a unified opposition to the Syrian government. It would be interesting to see if real leadership emerges there. And in general, we will see if the Arab Spring turns into a long, hot summer in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Libya, and we will keep following it very closely on this program, especially in this 11 o'clock segment on many, many days. And I want to thank again Jonathan Landis, who writes the online newsletter Syria Comment and teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure being on with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a man with an unusual medical history is apparently cured of AIDS. We'll get his story and hear why it's reviving interest in AIDS cure research generally. Stay tuned.